All right. Hello and welcome everyone to whoever's listening to this particular podcast. Today we have with us Dr. Maitra Raghu, who is a senior research scientist at Google Brain. She completed her PhD very recently from Cornell University, a PhD in computer science. And most of her research work focuses on analyzing internal working of deep neural networks that can help us better deploy these models, keeping humans in the loop. And previously, she did her bachelor's and master's in mathematics from University of Cambridge. And many of her awards, she has received many of awards for her research works, including the Forbes 30 Under 30. So hello and welcome Dr. Raghu for this particular podcast.
Oh, well, thanks very much for inviting me, Jay.
All right. So to learn more about your research interests and the projects you work on, can you tell us what is the research problem that you are trying to solve with your projects? And can you mention a few of your works that you're currently working on?
Yeah, definitely. So I think broadly speaking, as you know, you were describing, my research is really focused on understanding properties of our modern AI systems. And a specific focus there has been really looking at their internals and really understanding what they're doing. So connections to things like interpretability and stuff also. And I think the overarching theme motivating all of this is ideally to help us build these systems in a way that make them easier to use for people. So really thinking about, well, at the end, they're going to be used, they have to interact with people. Can we make all of that better by actually understanding what's going on with these systems also better?
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, does this fall or maybe intersect with the domains that is really popular right now, which is the XAI, like explainability, interpretability?
Yeah.
Do these overlap, or are we talking about the same thing over here?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely overlap. I think I broadly see my work as maybe falling into two categories. So one part is thinking about the design of these systems. So, you know, what kinds of insights can we get to better design these architectures? Can we preemptively predict the kinds of things that they might fail at? Like those kinds of questions. And then there's like a connection between the design part to, I think, maybe some of the things that XAI has also been specifically focused on, which is the decision-making part. So after we've designed these architectures, and then we, you know, we train them, we do all this work, and then we can put them out there. And then there's like a whole another set of questions we have to ask, which is, well, now, you know, these architectures are going to be informing decision-making in some way. And, you know, one application area we've looked a lot at is medicine. And one interesting thing about that application area that's common to many other applications of AI and machine learning is that there are experts in this area. So when you're using these systems for decision-making, it's not like you're not having the experts in the picture. The system and the experts are trying to make decisions together. So then there's questions of like, well, how can this system best assist the experts in performing this kind of decision-making? And so there are some like explainability styled components to that also, or like some design and explainability styled components that we've explored in, for example, some of our work thinking about designing some of these architectures for medical imaging and thinking about the effects that techniques like transfer learning might have. Like, are they likely to work well? Are they likely to cause certain failures? Things of that form, and you know, how that might affect decision-making. Then I'd say there's also questions on the pure decision-making side, which is just, what are we even predicting and why? Like, do we have the right task definition in mind? Should we be thinking about a variation of that to help experts with decision-making? So that's come up in a lot of this work we've done on human AI decision-making in medicine. So thinking about things that will help save time of doctors instead of necessarily having the system predicting like the end output alone all by itself, because again, typically it's like a partnership. So sometimes the best things you could do for these like busy human experts is to help direct their attention to, you know, the cases that might be most urgent or cases that might be most complicated also, and help in those kinds of ways.
Yeah, definitely. I can relate to a few of these use cases, definitely. And so I have seen like most of your research work, like if I do a breadth first search on most of these recent of your research works, I see there are two types of research works any kind of CS student can do, is much more on the applied side versus theoretical or understanding. Mm-hmm. And so in order to learn more, like, what really interested you more about the learnings of these internal representations of these deep learning networks versus using it for some kind of application, much more on the applied side. So in a sense, like how, what interested you more about this particular topic? And I also want to zoom out on that particular question is like, what interested you about deep learning in its first place? So right. how did you decide this particular topic to be your research and versus how did you get started into deep learning?
Okay, so yeah, so I think I have answers for questions one and two. So in question one onto why I got excited about maybe analyzing properties of neural network representations and, you know, this question of like, whether is there a theory divide or like an applied divide and maybe how do you decide between those? So actually, I think I got excited by some of these questions on representations because I feel like they bridged some of the theory and the applied part. So, you know, one thing that I think I've really seen emerge as a research area, which wasn't quite as much the case, it feels like some years back, certainly when I was starting my PhD, is there are these intermediate sets of questions that, you know, can be somewhat connected to theory in various ways. Like it's really about understanding how something works or having something very systematic and principled that you're doing. But there's also a very like strong connection to the applied side, because the way you're doing this systematic and principled understanding is actually through like a lot of experiments, like so as some kind of like a systematic study. And I think these kinds of approaches are very common in other areas of science, but at least in machine learning, it feels like it took us some time because it's only after the system started getting more and more complicated that people were like, well, wait, actually, we should take a step back and then really try and understand what's going on with some of these more systematic empirical studies. So I was very excited about the prospect of doing some of these systematic empirical studies. I'll come to my initial interest in deep learning in a sec, which also had that connection. And then when you start thinking about doing some of these systematic empirical studies, it just felt like a huge shortcoming when at least when I was starting in the field,
It still is.
No, so I really do think we have many more systematic empirical studies. So that's very exciting to see. And then when I was getting started, it just felt like we should also have more insights into what's happening in the internals of these systems, because that's where a lot of the complexity is. Like the input, you know, we've been understanding better and better. And then the output is usually very human intelligible. So it's easy to sort of test that and take a look at what's going on. But the internals of how these representations are computed, how also like, you know, some of our models can learn such sophisticated things from the data, that felt like a real mystery. And so that's what really prompted me to think about studying the internal representations of all of these systems. And then, like I said, the other thing I liked is that I think through the course of my work also, through, I don't know, like various results we've had from thinking about like how these systems like train or, you know, differences between different architectures to, you know, application specific considerations, like, you know, medical applications and stuff. Oftentimes by studying what's happening in the internals of these systems, you learn about like other phenomena that they exhibit that turn out to be very relevant, either for thinking about better designing them or better using them in some applications. So that was really exciting. And I felt like this entire area has really helped bridge, well, not just the studying representations area, but more broadly has really helped bridge areas of theory and practice and given rise to lots of interesting questions. So that's how I see it kind of connect between like theory and practice. And I feel like there's this really exciting intermediate area that maybe has nice connections to both. And as for what got me excited in deep learning in the beginning, I can actually, there's a little bit of a story there, which is I was starting my PhD back in 2014. I think as far as the AI world is considered, that feels like the dinosaur era or something.
Yeah.
We didn't have TensorFlow. We definitely didn't have PyTorch. The first things I tried writing code in were Theano. So it was really quite different. And, I started and I knew I was interested in machine learning, but I didn't know too much about the field or anything yet. I was still learning all of this. And it so happened that NeurIPS that year, I have one of my NeurIPS mugs here, but NeurIPS that year was taking place quite close to Cornell in Montreal. And in particular, the Women in Machine Learning workshop, which seemed interesting to me, was taking place there also. So I actually only attended that first NeurIPS in 2014 because I was planning on attending the Women in Machine Learning workshop. So sort of we all went there. And then as soon as I got there, because the NeurIPS community at that that point had like a reasonably large contingent that was very excited about deep learning. You know, 2 years back is when like AlexNet and stuff had been introduced. So there was just a lot of excitement. You know, that's when I first came across like the degree of excitement that there was in like a very core part of the community. So there, I have a like, you know, very memorable a moment of going to this talk, which was, I think, this paper on how transferable are features in deep neural networks, actually by someone who later became a co-author of mine. And then just sort of seeing some of these, one of these systematic experiments being conducted on one of these vision models. And there are two things that were really striking. Firstly, you know, the fact that this model could just learn to detect all of these pretty sophisticated things in natural images automatically was just super cool to see. And then, of course, the deconstruction to understand what exactly was happening, like, you know, how the features were being learned, was just absolutely fascinating. So I think from that point on, I was pretty hooked, and I was super excited to work on this area.
Yeah, definitely. This sounds very interesting. And I always envy people who started the research works or at least had the chance of exposure from or after 2012. So because those are the people who really know how the deep learning curve has emerged, right? Like people like me who started in, let's say, 2020, we are pretty much out of the bubble. Like it's like the bubble has happened and we are just trying to cope up, you know?
Yeah, we are
just trying to cope up. Like what happened? Okay, let's start back in 2012. We try to go through all the citations. What's the trend? So it's hard to keep up. But yeah, definitely. But this sounds...
I definitely empathize about the difficulty of keeping up. I think that's a challenge everyone has. But I mean, one maybe small positive, or actually one pretty significant positive for now, is it is much easier to do all of this research. So yeah. I think back then it was, you know, it's just hard because they didn't have nearly as much like, you know, software or packages out there or notions of best practices. And so it was like the knowledge was contained in sort of some pockets of people, and you had to try and talk to those people or those groups to understand how you could do this work. And so, So from that sense, I feel like things are much more accessible now, which is great. But I do also think the field has sort of exploded now. So
But a strong caveat to that saying is like, it's easy to conduct the research, but it's hard to publish, you know? I didn't know iPad did that. Okay, I didn't know it created that emoji because I did this. Okay, but a strong caveat I've realized as a student, and maybe this is just my first year talking into it, is like it's easy to conduct research, but it's really hard to publish because everything you see out there, like somebody has done something or the other similar stuff. So yeah, definitely. But
maybe my advice there would be, it's true, like there are a ton of people in the field, and there's there's definitely like it's hard to not avoid some like overlap in ideas. That would be my advice. I mean, I do feel like there are certain directions that are underexplored, like for example, a lot of interdisciplinary directions. I think there's a lot more scope to explore them. You know, for all of this time, I think a lot of aspects of machine learning didn't work well enough for us to seriously consider some of the more interdisciplinary applications. And now I think that could be a much more much more solid and like reliable direction to go in, and so much more work that can be done there. I think some of the human AI decision making is maybe also underexplored. But then, you know, I don't know. Otherwise, my advice would be, you know, definitely try and learn as much of the field as possible, and you know, learn what like some of the classical results are and stuff, so you're not, you know, reinventing the wheel. But like otherwise, it's also okay to get excited about a direction and a problem, and then maybe get people's perspectives on that problem, so you know whether, you know, it's an exciting thing to be working on. And then, you know, spending some time trying to flesh it out and make progress without worrying too much about whether there's, you know, you're going to get scooped or something, just to give yourself a bit of that space. And then once you've, you know, gotten some more concrete results and things, then kind of, you know, worry about like publishing it and things, just because otherwise, you know, like ideas in some way, like everything, like ideas that are in abstract can encapsulate like a lot of work. And, you know, oftentimes like the specifics of how somebody has done something, like there tends to be some variation in that at least. So it's okay to give yourself a bit of space to explore those parts. And then, you know, then maybe see about like pushing certain differentiating factors or something like that, if that becomes relevant.
Yeah. No, this is very meaningful. And I just want to pin this thing, these two topics, because we'll be revisiting them, is basically exploring the interdisciplinary aspects of deep learning research and definitely developing a research vision, which definitely you talk more about it right now, but which I want to explore more on that too.
Sure.
But before we got that, I'm just going to pin those topics and we will revisit them later. But one of the key things that you mentioned, which got you interested or maybe hooked up into the deep learning research, was about the workings that you said, like how these models really work and how these structures really operate, right? So can you tell, like, this is one thing I've explored, and this is even you would have gone through, is like, once we don't know how these deep learning networks, everything about the network really awes us, that, hey, how is this working? But once we start to learn more about the different components, what are the mathematical functions and what are the traits these models have, we try to understand these better. So you have been working on analyzing the structures and representations of these models. What is one thing or one component of a deep learning network that you would still say that still puzzles you? You don't really know how that happens, but it just happens through the magic of more data or like systematic data that we put in. Go ahead.
So just something about deep learning models that even as we've been unraveling their structure, surprises me, maybe, in terms of in terms of how exactly it's like working.
As in you wouldn't have the first intuition saying that this particular thing would work, as in like it's such a simplistic or maybe not so complicated function. Like for example, for me, it was the activation function. When I learned what does an activation function does, if you see ReLU activations, it's simple as hell, right? Like you won't even understand what is the significance of that. But once you understand why did the person came up applying activation functions to this particular input to produce this particular output at this particular stage, it really awes us, like, oh wow, this is what it can be used for. So
I see
that
I
kind
see.
Of
I see
yeah
I mean,
you can you
uh-huh.
yeah
yeah well yeah. Okay, So I'd say like in the details of like the mechanics of how some of these architectures work, I'd say there are like so many things that, you know, if you think about for a while, you'll just be like, but why did we choose to do this or why did it work? And then there are post hoc explanations, but sometimes like the pre hoc explanations are hard to do. You know, I mean, occasionally we do things because somebody has like a great insight and has been like, you know, playing around and really understands like this is the right thing to do. But, you know, that tension between like, preemptively knowing that and then sort of post hoc being able to reason about it is like, you know, definitely something that continues throughout our field. Like, I guess most recently mechanically, as I was like on the mechanical side while I was working with some of the work we've done on vision transformers, it was definitely kind of magical to me that we could just give them these additional tokens, which are going to become like these position embeddings, and it would just learn all of that like correctly. Mm-hmm. And those would have like a lot of meaning that would help it determine like, you know, spatial positions and things of that form. So that was like pretty, that was pretty magical. As for like, maybe like kind of stepping back from that and maybe like away from the mechanics and just more high level on things that I wish I understood better. I wish I understood better. I think maybe more of the precise effects of things like transfer learning and multitask learning. So it's like transfer learning, we got started with that, you know, with this paper we had on studying transfer learning between natural images and medical images. I still think, and you know, transfer learning has just exploded. Like everyone uses transfer learning. You've got it for like the natural language data sets. You've got it for like computer vision data sets. It's like everywhere. And yeah, I think I wish I understood better, well, you know, like how exactly is it working and like really like into the details of like why. I mean, I understand some of it. Like I think there are some earlier features that can be like reused, or at least there's like good conditioning that happens when you pre-train on certain things. And then somehow like you can use those same kinds of things for like, say like medical data sets or something. But then in that case, like, you know, if you can do that, then why do we still struggle with stuff like out of distribution, like images, for example? Mm. Like, why is it that we can have this flexibility happen here? And then, you know, like, but for like out of distribution, maybe it's, so somehow you see this failure, like, can we really get at that and understand statistically what's going on? I think another thing, I guess I'm talking about a few things. So there's like the mechanical stuff and thinking about positional embeddings. There's maybe some of these questions on things like transfer learning, multitask learning. Also, like, you can end up with these different objectives, and then, you know, how does that go on to really influence like what the system trains, and what are like, you know, similarities and differences as you play around with the objectives. Some of these connections to things like out of distribution, like why is that hard for us still? How can we make that less hard? And then I think maybe on a like kind of another sort of Pure-esque like question of interest is, you know, do we have good ways of like actually combining neural networks? So we've done things like distillation, we've done things like ensembling, but can we like go beyond that into like the actual weights and stuff, for example, and see how to put them together? That's pretty challenging. But I wonder if there's like better knowledge sharing that can happen. I think that would be really interesting just from the perspective, like for like lots of reasons, because we tend to train a lot of models. So it would be very exciting if we could just do some kind of combination, but like in a deeper way than like distillation or ensembling. And then with some of these like larger models that are coming out, like maybe this would give us insights on like how to extract specific bits of like knowledge. That's always been something that's interested me, like also related to transfer learning, which is, do we need to be thinking about, you know, fine tuning the whole model? Can we just extract what we need from the model in some sense? And are there other methods for doing that?
And just a curious question is, like, when you said the idea about like combining two models, as in like fusing two trained models together, as in, was that the
because there is variation in like, you know, how these systems learn, what they learn, things like that. We know this from some of the representational analysis methods we've done, all of those things. So there are various insights we can get on their design, but then there's also a basic question of like, if we wanted to fuse a couple of models together, what's the good way of doing that? What's the good way of collecting their knowledge beyond ensembling or things of that form?
Interesting. Yeah, I'll definitely revisit this particular question if we get the time after we have this one. Uh-huh. But this is interesting. I've never thought about this. This is interesting. But I want to jump into your research domain. But before that, I just have one question. This is something I always had when I started my PhD. And maybe you graduated very recently, so I can ask this. And you would be the perfect candidate. I can ask is, what is the difference being a researcher when you are in an academic setting as a PhD student versus at a big organization? As in, I see most of the research scientists, they are pretty much working on very impactful projects because majority of the research works are being published. There are the most influential ones or the most cited ones that really carry on forward are coming from the industry, right? So what is the difference you have seen working as a researcher in both of these settings? And what does your work routine look like as a senior research scientist?
So good questions. So I think maybe this is like an academia versus industry styled question. I would say even on the academic side, so I guess some context, yeah, I did indeed recently wrap up my PhD. I also seriously considered taking up a faculty position. So I guess I got the full experience from a PhD student to thinking about being faculty to then also having this industry exposure. So on the academic side, I think there is quite a big difference between when you're a PhD student versus when you're a faculty member. And then on the industry side, there's like, you know, a research scientist, like degree of that form. And the differences between, some of the considerations for academia and industry and the similarities and differences between them, I think have also been influenced by how like the field has been changing over time. So I'd say some years ago, there's a big difference between being a PhD student and being a faculty member. Like those roles are a little different. And, you know, I think that's probably going to be well understood. So maybe I won't go into that. I'd say that like in terms of the type of research you might do in like academia versus like in a big research lab, like some years back, I'd say that there'd be quite a bit of similarity between it just because I think maybe the field was even younger. Though I think even like a few years back, maybe you were seeing a little bit more like, so originally it felt like some of the modeling and things like that was happening in academia. Then of course some things like grew in scale. So then you saw like more industry like efforts there on like, you know, various like modeling related things and stuff of that form. I think right now, maybe one difference I see is, so the field has gotten quite a bit more mature, I would say. So I think there are some directions that are not as large scale in nature. And I think those are, you know, definitely well represented in academia. And then there are sometimes people in industry working on them also. There are also some other directions that are just inherently a bit more large scale. And I think those directions like are seeing like more, you know, industry like development and things these days, because I think that's also partly to do with like, you know, where the field is in that state. Like we've had this suite of techniques being developed and then like, you know, becoming really standardized. And then like then the next question is like, how far can you scale that up? And, you know, I think in some ways that question is like very well represented in industry. The other aspect or other difference that I've seen like quite recently, I would say, is also partially thanks to maybe thinking about things of more scale and stuff. And actually maybe historically also, I think I'd say there's a little bit more of like a history in industry of having like larger teams come together to work on things, typically because when you're looking at one of these like larger scale projects, you're gonna like need multiple people to really work on various aspects so you can build it out in that way. So I think that's like, those are some differences that, you know, I think we've seen, but I think these are actually historically maybe differences that have existed between industry and academia. Like I'd say fundamentally industry and academia are trying to do slightly different things. And so, you know, it makes sense that there would be sort of some of these differences between them. I think machine learning has been interesting because as a field, it's been quite new. And so as a result for a lot of the history, we've actually seen industry and academia be very close in the things that they try and do. But like historically, you know, that has definitely not always been the case. And there are definitely like, you know, stages in like the cycle of any sort of field in terms of how it's being studied across industry and academia.
Yeah. I totally agree to that. And if I can add to that, is I've realized the same thing, but in a different sense, is that if you follow works that are strictly out of an academic settings, you see a lot of variety in terms of what are the trials the person would have done, as in terms of ideas. You know, the exploratory part is much more broader versus the industry research is much more robust, as in like solving a particular problem or kind of an application or something like that. Of course, it's research focused, but it is built in such a way so that you can reproduce and use it for different purposes.
Exactly.
But yeah, academics are the ones who take the first shot at doing those things and exploring and doing a lot of wrong things versus right things, and then publishing up these results.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is like definitely a part of it, and that is also representative of I think some of the differences in the like area, like definitely like in academia, the idea is to like explore lots of different things and also interdisciplinary things and stuff, like, you know, just try out like what's going to be there. Like I think in industry, this might even be true a few years earlier, like even a few years back, like even when the field was younger and stuff. I do think the emphasis, if you're like, for example, trying to build a new model architecture or something, is like really aspects of like also pushing like the limits of performance and things. You know, of course, like industry research is huge. So I don't think this speaks for all research. And I have actually not done as much work of that kind, simply because of, I guess, my interests. But I think that is like a theme, and there's obviously good things about it, because then you can take this thing and then you can like reproduce it and use it in lots of ways. So like things like BERT, I guess, went off to be like enormously useful for a lot of people. And that was fantastic. And then there's like flip sides to it, which is that they tend to be like more complicated or have like, you know, large scale. And then, you know, ultimately some of the like ideas that go into it or the things that really make it work might be more fiddly and things. Like there might not be something conceptually clean to take out of it necessarily. So there are all of those aspects.
Yeah. And jumping on that, onto that particular topic, is so a little bit context for the people who are listening is, so you recently wrote out a very nice analysis article comparing the representational structures of vision transformers versus typical, like the best convolutional neural network that we have is ResNet models. And I think it was a very nice representational comparison. And So, a slight more context, zooming out, as vision transformers was something they published out of Google Research, where they are taking a very transformer architecture-based approach to solving imaging tasks that are typically normally always tackled using convolutions. So you did a very head-to-head comparison. That's the best manner we can use for the standard datasets, ImageNet. So I'm curious, and this is something I have been using and trying to explore for even my projects that I'm trying to do for certain reasons. Like, of course, I'm not targeting accuracies in that particular reason, but I'm curious, based on your analysis, and I read the paper, but something I want to ask on an overarching question is, where do you think VITs or the vision transformers have a clear advantage, if at all they have, to solving a particular task that convolutions might not have, versus what are some of the tasks that you will say which are still inherent to CNNs? They cannot be solved using vision transformers, and we shouldn't expect vision transformers to overrule CNNs.
Right. So I guess in answering this question, maybe I'll also draw on some of, you know, the results we had in our paper. So, you know, broadly, I'd say probably CNNs still have an advantage in places where you might not have you know, as much data, or you might not be able to easily perform things like transfer learning. I think in situations where if you can expect transfer learning to work well, you can actually expect a vision transformer to do a good job, because they've been like testing that with sort of taking it and then having a pre-trained model and then seeing how it works as you fine-tune it on different data sets and things. But you know, if there are settings where, you know, you think this kind of fine-tuning from like, you know, one of these standard pre-trained setups is not going to work super well, then definitely the CNN would have the advantage there. I think also, you know, the first results were really only on image classification. I think there's like, you know, follow-up work going on extending that to like other tasks like object detection. I need to check, but like, you know, I imagine some of these other tasks which have taken us a while to develop just in terms of like CNNs might take like a little bit longer to develop in terms of like vision transformers. We might have to revisit a lot of that design and then think about how we're going to do it again. And then similar for like, you know, aspects of things like image generation. I think if I were speaking more fundamentally, I would say I do think CNNs have a very powerful and useful inductive bias of the convolution. And when there's going to be limited data available, I just feel like I see that being very useful. On the other hand, and this is just drawing on results of our paper, we find that because vision transformers don't have this inductive bias and like this convolution, and instead what they have is this global self-attention layer, if you can train them properly, sometimes that can lead them to getting very strong representations even earlier on in the network. So one thing we find, because this global self-attention, because it doesn't have this nice inductive bias, then when it like learns to do the right thing in some sense, it can incorporate, you know, some amount of like local information, it can incorporate some amount of more global information. And what we find is that leads to like very strong representations, even pretty early on in the architecture. So you can do certain like linear probes like tests between the ConvNet and the vision transformer. So you'll go ahead to some intermediate representation, and then you'll see how well it can classify on some task just based off of that intermediate representation. And then in those kinds of evaluations, the vision transformer ends up doing actually a lot better. And we think that's because it's managed to aggregate, it's managed to, you know, really utilize self-attention to aggregate things in a more helpful way that prepare it to do things like that. So I'd say that I guess that the vision transformer has access to enough data to be able to really make best use of its self-attention mechanism, then that can lead to some very strong representations that I think should actually give it a pretty strong advantage against CNNs, simply because they have this thing hard-coded, and there is like also a downside to having things hard-coded. But on the other hand, there is this big thing of, can you train the vision transformer to actually use its self-attention effectively in that way? And if you can't do that, then I feel like the CNNs are going to be definitely better to go with, because they've gotten the inductive bias they have. I mean, it's hard-coded, but it's also been just enormously successful. And so that would be like a good direction to look into.
Right. And to understand the intuition, basically, like when we have this very fair understanding of what convolutions really learn, right? Like what do we mean when we say representations, when we talk about convolution neural networks, as in we have these techniques that has helped us in some way to understand, like, for example, the outputs of saliency maps or grad camps that help us understand and visualize these weights, and we can see actually what exactly the model is trying to learn. So this might be a very naive question, but when we do these kind of analysis, what is the learning? Like, because transformers, like purely transformer-based models, don't have kernels or anything like that. If I'm right. So what is the learning going on? If anyone wants to understand the intuition, what's the learning representation what is the representation in general going on in the model that is being learned in iterations or epochs?
Yeah, so I think you could. So we didn't look at the saliency map things ourselves exactly, but I think you could do very similar analyses with the vision transformer and get good insights for what's going on for a couple of reasons. So firstly, I think analysis of self-attention is a relatively straightforward thing to do because you have this like notion of distance and you can think about how different distances are being attended to and what's going on. We do some of that in our paper, and then there's like nice structures we uncover. One thing which I just mentioned, which is this like local global information kind of thing. And so that will give you some insight into what's happening and how it's functioning. And then for the other places, so like one nice thing architecturally about the vision transformer is that it takes in these image patches. And then all of its like work is transforming embeddings of these image patches. But then as a result, like you still have very good information on like, you know, what each patch is and then what each patch is mapped to as you go through the architecture. And so you could do all kinds of things. You could try and study magnitudes of like different patches or things of that form. We touched on one such experiment towards the end of our paper, motivated by object detection. So there, what we were trying to do is take these image patches and then sort of take something much higher up the network that also, you know, came from one of these patches, and then try and get a sense of like whether the transformer knew where that patch had come from, essentially. So whether the transformer preserved spatial information well. And it turned out it actually did do a pretty great job of preserving spatial information. So that was really cool to see. So we could kind of like walk around what patch we wanted to look at and then see the corresponding like thing light up at the top here. So that was really fun. There are those kinds of correspondences possible. And so I think we will see, we will see like many more analyses. There's also, a paper that was, I think, almost released concurrently with ours, maybe a little bit before, where I think they took an even more fine-grained vision transformer, by which I mean the image patches were even smaller, so they could really probe what it was looking at. And just by doing an analysis of the self-attention, they managed to get like a saliency-styled map. I think this paper was from Facebook. It might have been called Dino or something. They have a GitHub page. It's like it's worth looking up. It's very cool to see that. And so I think those kinds of things will give us insights into what these models are like doing and how they're working. Like the transformer has a pretty regular structure in many ways, like even more so than CNNs, because they have a bit more of a pyramid like structure and stuff. And so from certain perspectives of analysis, I think it might even be easier to understand what's going on in the transformer. So I'm excited to see what other kinds of things people discover with those models.
Right. And I'm also curious, as in the original transformer model, they have mentioned this one thing is the transformer model wouldn't work well than the standard ResNet results if we are using small-sized or mid-sized data sets. And we are referring to the ImageNet data set here. Yeah. But it would perform its beauty or whatever it does when we are using large data sets. And like you said, CNNs still perform better when we have smaller data sets. So from understanding from a representational structure, why does it take long to learn its whatever representations, or I don't know, I would say weights for now, is like, why does a transformer model take longer or maybe bigger data sets to learn few things compared to the CNNs? Like, what is the internal working going on that takes it? Or is it the structure, like you said, the distances that is being learned over time and the spatial versus global information? Is that the reason that is causing?
So I can't claim this answers everything fully, but I think this is a really big factor of it, is what happens with self-attention. Because the self-attention is the thing that you're really trying to get to act as like a convolution, like it's acting across all of these tokens, like acting all across all of these patches. So that's like the one thing you have for aggregating information. Like otherwise you're, doing also like patch level transforms and stuff. And so so I feel like the question about, what does it take to get it to work? Well, like really, a really, really important component of that is like what is happening with the self-attention layers. And so what we find is that with mid-sized data sets, if you train some of these larger transformer models, they don't seem to quite be learning to do the right thing with self-attention. So even earlier on in the network, their self-attention layers are just entirely attending globally. And that might not be good for, and in fact, our suspicion is that isn't good for image processing, because you want to be able to take into account the local neighborhoods. Whereas what we see when you take one of these same models and then train them with a much larger data set is that then these self-attention layers will actually learn to pay attention to neighborhood patches. But then because they don't have hard coding, they'll also learn to pay attention to like some amount of like further away patches. And I think the combination of the two of them is quite important for having high-performing transformer neural networks. So I actually think this is a really fun open question if somebody wants to really go and specifically test this, which is just try and play around with the architecture to force it to learn things more globally, and then play around with it in the other extreme side to just force it to learn things more locally, and then see the ramifications of that on performance, or maybe just do this ablation. But one thing we see when we train these architectures on different data set sizes is precisely this, like the behavior of the self-attention seems to change. And I think that is going to be really integral for getting good image representations. So
so it's definitely like something that transformers can provide you with additional insights, but only if it comes at a cost of having bigger data sets. So but I'm curious, have you used, because you have a background of using AI or deep learning for healthcare applications too, have you ever explored using transformers for any of these standard medical data sets? And I'm curious, like, if you have any anything to report, or I don't know if I missed any out of your works that have been already done on that.
We did try fine tuning on one of one medical imaging data set in our paper. I think that plot is in the appendix. That was just understanding, like, you know, how fine tuning was working, whether representations were good and things like that. And that was and like how much things were changing. So that was nice. This was also relevant to your earlier question, but. Yeah, I was actually excited about this from the medical perspective also, because one challenge you have with medical images is that the images can be very large scale. And so when you're working with like a convolutional net, like, I mean, I don't know, do you like downsample it, or like sometimes the batch size has to be smaller. And so I was hoping that with transformer networks, like while you might have to play around to understand, like, you know, exactly how large the image patches should be and things of that form, transformers might provide us a little bit of an advantage in processing these kinds of medical images. I also feel like what we observed to the transformers, that it can take like local and global information into account, would be very, I think, very relevant for some of these medical imaging data sets. So I feel like one architectural problem with CNNs maybe is that sometimes these like medical imaging data sets, what you ideally want to do is you want to take like local information into account like a lot, and then you want just like a small amount of global information to maybe understand like where you are in the image or something. Because oftentimes the variations you're looking for are quite a bit more local. But then like it's useful to just have like, you know, a notion of what the global context is like. And with CNNs, like there's nothing in that structure that like, you know, necessarily helps with that. Like lower down, you're sort of forced to be local, but then higher up, you're like looking at the entire image like all the time. And so is that really the right thing to do? It actually felt like maybe not. This was also one of the things that motivated our study on like different architectures going from like, you know, natural images to medical images. Like some of those architectures are really, you know, developed for natural images. And so like have all of these properties that don't quite make sense for medical images. With vision transformers, because we know that they can take like local and global information into account this way earlier on, and because we know that they have like more flexibility to see how much of each they want, I was actually really excited to see whether these could be used for medical imaging data sets. We haven't done too much yet besides some preliminary experiments in our paper, which is mostly in the context of transfer learning, but that's definitely something I'm hoping to explore more in future.
Yeah, and that makes two of us, definitely. So, it's something I have been trying on a lot. But I have always regarded all of my experiments to the in-house data set that we have from Mayo Clinic, and it's strictly very lesser in size. So I'm always curious that, okay, the transformers won't even wake up if I just have this many amount of samples.
It's possible that with like pre-trained data set or something, if you're just doing transfer learning and stuff, you might still be able to get them to work. Like, I don't think like some of the things that they did fine tuning on in the original VIT paper, like those data sets aren't particularly big, I think. And so they just managed to do that with like some of the fine tuning. And so I would be cautiously optimistic that to be made work.
Yeah, I actually want to ask that because, like you said, because that was one of the question I would say concern that I had for myself is, uh-huh. so We have done, like most of the people have done work on transfer learning when they are regarding for natural imaging data sets. So they would, of course, like using pre-trained ImageNet models have been a big consensus among the whole community. But I wanted to ask from a theoretical perspective, from how the transformers work, would it be theoretically wrong, let's say if I, for medical data sets, of course, we are just talking about MR scans or something like that. Would it be theoretically wrong if I trained a model on a particular pathology of disease or something that has to do with a different application, but the modality is the same, as in we are talking about CT scans or MR scans consistently, and I would fine-tune it on a downstream task that has a smaller sample to fine-tune on, but we are talking about different pathology, but same modality.
Same modalities.
Do you think, like, first of all, of course, like, I don't expect you would say like, okay, that's going to be great or not, because of course we have not done the experiments, but would it be theoretically wrong, as in would it be wrong as in what knowledge is being transferred from the pre-training to fine-tuning task?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely seems like a reasonable thing to try. Earlier on when I saw some of the first work, like for example, training on chest x-rays, because there are some large data sets out there with chest x-rays, I was wondering why we weren't, you know, transferring from chest x-rays to chest x-rays. But then what I learned is that when you're training, like say a model that has been built for something like ImageNet, the diversity of the data sets of something like ImageNet is like helpful for like doing conditioning a little faster. Like one chest x-ray and another chest x-ray are much more similar to each other than like one image and another image from like ImageNet. And so I think that diversity is like helpful for some kind of like conditioning or training. And so I think that would be like a question I would have for training on like, say the CT scans, just the CT scans and downstream training. I mean, like there are some other options there. Like if you have CT scans, but then, and you also have like maybe a natural data set available. So this is coming back to multitask learning, but I'd be curious to know whether you can just train on both of them at the same time. And then try, and that way you get a little bit of in-domain information, but then you also get like the diversity that you have with natural images, and then hopefully you've learned like a good stable set of representations that then you can use to fine-tune to whatever downstream thing you're interested in most. So that would be something I'd be curious to try, I guess. But I mean, otherwise, I don't see anything wrong in doing that. Like it feels very reasonable because you're giving it that image modality and hopefully it's learning something about that. I think the big question there would be, you know, is the diversity enough?
Definitely. Yeah, this is, that gives me a slightly bit more of motivation to do that, because I was always concerned that transformers are very data hungry models. So that's not going to be something very...
Okay, so this is almost turning into a research brainstorm, but I think there's a pretty nice open question there, maybe, which is, suppose you just trained on the CT scans and then you pre-trained on the CT scans and then you fine-tuned on the CT scans, what does that look like? And then you could do, suppose you trained on like ImageNet and then fine-tuned on the CT scans, what does that look like? And then maybe one more experiment, like mixing the two, like sort of what does that look like? And I think there would be something interesting to say about what those three like performances looked like.
I definitely bet on that. Yeah, definitely. But to end on the vision transformer thing, a very awkward question I would ask is, do you think transformers in general, the architecture or the model that it belongs to, as in what it does, do you think it has the potential or it has already done a paradigm shift the way we are approaching imaging tasks as of now, which is the de facto is convolutions, right? Like it's one or the other way we are using convolutions.
Yeah.
Do you think it has the potential? And feel free to say this is an opinion answer. No one's going to quote you on that. But do you think transformers have the potential, if done correctly, to provide something that can cause a paradigm shift with imaging applications?
Yeah, good question. So, definitely opinion answer. I mean, I do think, you know, I think that was definitely on people's minds when that paper first came out. You know, they're not the first papers to think about using transformers for vision, but because of course transformers are really successful, so people were always curious to know whether you could have some variant working in vision. But you know, as I understand, it felt like some of the prior work had made pretty significant modifications to the transformer architecture itself before trying to get it to work on vision. Whereas this one really tried to keep it faithful to like what the architecture exactly looked like for NLP. And so that was like really striking, the fact that you could take this and then it did well. And, you know, I think there's been like numerous follow-ups that are like, you know, either reproducing the results or like extending it in various settings. And so, you know, I think some of that has actually happened. Gosh, where does it go from here? I mean, I still think, yeah, you know, I still think there are probably some places where we might prefer using a CNN, like so places where maybe you have, like some of these like large transformer models which are working the best, they are very big. So like those might not be, you know, as appropriate for every application. Like I think things like ResNet, for example, have been around for a long time and there are many places where those work reliably. So it would be surprising if those just suddenly all disappeared. But, you know, I think there will be a whole suite of applications that are opened up by things we're doing. And, you know, some places where we're going to replace places where we had ResNet with a transformer. You know, I think one of the most interesting opportunities with like this use of vision transformers is, of course, all of these multimodal considerations. So OpenAI came out with their CLIP training framework like early this year. And that was very interesting, being able to do the joint embeddings of language and vision and then doing this sort of inner producting together and having that be like a new way of learning things. I think things like that are going to be really exciting. And maybe from that angle, it's a little easier to have architectural similarity between vision and language. I'm also hopeful for, you know, potential like medical applications there. Like, you know, we talked about explainability in the beginning. It would be very cool if we could get our systems to explain themselves better in natural language. That would be a very interesting direction to go. So if things like that come out of it, that could be really cool. But yeah, so maybe to summarize, I think definitely for larger scale applications, I think transformers are going to be really strong. I think for some of the existing applications where we're using CNNs that are maybe also slightly large scale in nature, like transformers could be useful. And then places where like, you know, transfer learning is possible, you're also going to see that. I certainly think there are going to be plenty of places where people are still using ConvNets going forward. And I think for some of the multimodal work, however, we really might see a lot of use of transformers, just because it seems really nice to have uniformness of architectures across like language and vision.
I really like the last part. Yeah, that's interesting, definitely. And talking more, like deviating more on your work on the medical data sets, because you have been working on the applications and understanding these model representations when we are dealing with medical data sets. So yeah. Of course, like you would expect this question to be coming, is we often, like one of the biggest problem with medical data sets is the size, right? So what do you think, like in terms of, because I have explored a lot of papers who talk about few shot learning, k shot learning, one shot learning, zero shot learning, but none of them have the sufficient amount of proof to show if we can scale that idea even for medical data sets. So where do you think, like, of course transformer is one thing that we really talk, like that's an open question. Apart from that, do you see the potentials in any of the other techniques that people might not know or that could have a potential, like you see a significant amount of people or interest in the research community for small data sets in medical medical?
I think I do. So I mean, this is something that, you know, people might already be familiar with, but one thing that has really surprised me in a very positive way is just over, say, 2019, especially like I think 2019 and some of 2020, you know, how much progress we made in things like semi-supervised learning and self-supervision. So, you know, language already had this nice property that you have like sort of next token kind of things. And then maybe with the vision transformer, you can try and get something like that to work for in the image context also, like so some kind of like next patch prediction. And that's like a new self-supervision paradigm that's come out now. But otherwise, like, you know, there have just been all of these efforts that like through contrastive learning of some kind, usually, that have been like really pushing the boundaries of what we can do with self-supervision and semi-supervised learning. So I think I'm pretty optimistic. So if I was looking at a domain where there was very little data, I think what I'd want to do is, you know, take a pre-trained model, then try and see like if there's like, you know, if you can get like a chunk of unlabeled data, then look at doing some like, you know, semi-supervised learning. And then if the unlabeled data isn't available, then just look at doing some careful like transfer learning from the pre-trained setup. And I guess I'm like cautious and like especially for medical images that are like larger scale, I think you can also do quite a bit of data augmentation to increase the size of the data set. That tends to work well because they often have high resolution. So there's more scope to do augmentation, I guess. So it depends on the precise size of the data set and things, of course. But I guess I'm optimistic about being able to do much more with smaller size data sets, with the enormous advances we've seen in both like self-supervision and semi-supervised learning, and just like, again, improving aspects of transfer learning. Like, I do think this is one case where like model scale is helping us, where you can have some of these large scale models, but they actually have amazingly good representation. So they can actually be very efficient to do transfer learning on, which is sometimes counterintuitive. You take a large model and you're like, gosh, like I can never use this. Like it's going to be so expensive to, or like so expensive data wise, at least to fine tune. Like I'm going to need so many data points, but that may often not be true because these larger models might just have really strong representation. So often they'll need very little data to fine tune and start doing well on whatever task you're most interested in. So I think I'm actually very optimistic on all of this. And those are some of the techniques and directions I would think about if I were trying to carry this out.
Yeah, it's a very weird sweet spot between the model sizes, because if you have a smaller model, they are not suitable for transfer learning. And if they are too large, it's harder to update if you have a very fine-tuned, like very small fine-tuned data set, if I'm correct. I'm not sure if that's the exact conclusion, but it's a very sweet spot between like what should be the model size if you want to do a very good amount of transfer learning. So
the larger models might help there. Like, I mean, there are of course compute challenges. So like there's like some, you know, maybe you don't want to go for something ginormous, like that might be like a pain, but you know, taking some computation considerations into account, I think some of the larger models might be helpful for fine-tuning, even if there's like a smaller amount of data available. That would be my, I mean, again, probably application dependent a little bit and things, but I guess a priori would be my guess.
Yeah, definitely. And one last question I have before we move on to a slightly lesser technical domain is, from you have been working on analyzing the representations of these models. So from an internal representation perspective, and I'll have to admit, I don't know much about causality. I just read papers in a reading about something that's going to change things that can help us understand things better. But I don't know much about the causalities or what the research about causality really goes. But what can you say about, like, representations help us understand what the model learns in terms of what are the structural or the physical or tangible things that we learn, but what can representations or these internal workings help us understand the causalities between the learned features or data sets, data points, I would say? Is there any work being done where people are trying to understand causality or causal reasoning of these models, and can representations help us?
I think for that, you definitely want to run some of these interventional experiments. So you have some hypothesis and then you change something, maybe about how the model is trained, and then you test that out. We do try and do things like that when we analyze representations. So our usual like workflow is that we'll, you know, take some system and we might be analyzing its representations. That will give us some, you know, clear hypothesis or insight on what we think is going on. And then we'll usually try and separately test that in some way, you know, by changing like the training mechanism or I don't know, like ablating something or something of that form. So I think if you're going to do this for data sets thinking about maybe the connection between data and like what the model is learning, what I would be tempted to do, I guess, is like also trying to think of some kind of ablation style study. So like maybe this set of classes on the data sets, like if I remove those, like how does that affect properties of the representation? And so once you've done that interventional test, so you have like test A and test B, like different variations of how you're maybe training this model, for example, then that's definitely a place where representation like analysis could help you. You'd look at the learned representations in both of these. So you'd have like some sense of maybe like errors and outputs, like, you know, sort of for free once you've done this. And then you might want to look at like, I don't know, like internal representations or even just like things like saliency and stuff to understand whether there are other differences between these systems that are worth taking into account.
Interesting. Yeah. That makes sense. And I want to graduate towards the idea that is slightly less technical. And since most of the people who are listening to this podcast are, I would say, people who are interested in research, or I would say masters or PhD students. So I want to ask a question about along the lines of understanding your thought process when you were a PhD student. So first of all, how did you decide your own PhD research topic? And secondly, would you have any advice for people who are trying to develop their research topic or thesis, or in general, the idea that what they want to work on? Can you talk to more about like what was your thought process then?
Yeah, so I think developing that, and you know, I think oftentimes like maybe something close to what I would advise people, I think is also probably my experience, just because organically this is often like the way things turn out to be. But yeah, I guess it's like some combination, sort of high level, it's some combination of exploration to find out, you know, what you're really excited about. And then once you found something that's more exciting, you can then, you know, really push on that and really flesh it out as a direction. In terms of exploring, so like, I think like concretely, you know, maybe you want to be doing some combination of, you know, spending time really like learning about like certain papers or techniques that you start off being excited about. And then at the same time, you're trying to work on concrete projects to understand, like to really dive into the details of like of trying to do research there. And these two things sort of feed off of each other. Like when you first start reading papers, it's, you know, it's illuminating and it's interesting, but the depth in which you understand them is different once you've started doing research yourself in that area, because you better understand, you know, what are the important parts, what are the less important parts, what are you most interested by, what's less exciting to you, things like that. And so you like kind of go back and forth between these. I'd say for like starting PhD students, I would recommend, you know, like doing this for maybe it's sequentially, but like, you know, sequentially for like a couple of different areas they're excited about. So maybe you pick one area and then you try and learn about it, work on a project too, and you're doing a combination of following that area and then also trying to work on a project, try and wrap up that project also, or like, you know, like see the project to completion is what I would say, because that like that process of working through a project until it's like a paper is like really an important part of doing research also. So you do that and then you get some sense of that area, and then maybe you pick another area that you're excited about, or somehow if the first area you picked is just magical, then maybe you just continue. You found the area you're really excited about. But if not, and you're, you know, excited about other areas also, maybe, you know, you do this again, or you do this a couple of times, basically like a few times. And so then once you've done that, you've written a few papers, you've gotten a sense of what that process is like, you know, what doing research is like, you've learned a lot about the field. And then at that stage, you can start getting a sense of like, okay, well, you know, what did I like most about this? Like, what direction would I like to go? How am I seeing like, you know, things like evolve in the field also? What's like the new work coming out that's exciting me? And so then, and then that will like, help maybe inform like the next set of projects you start working on, and then by that point, like, you know, slowly cohesive, like a theme will start forming, and so then like at some stage, like, you know, a few years into your PhD, you can usually look at all the work you've done and there's like, you know, some clearer themes that are coming out to that, and so then I think like, you know, kind of maybe midway or like in the like latter half of your PhD or so, like that's when you're sort of taking some of the themes that are coming out and then like maybe really pushing on them to because you realize that those are like the directions you're most interested in, and then you're like maybe exploring them to like their full, or like studying other questions there that you thought were interesting that like came out. This process also gets easier once, again, like, I mean, one other nice thing about like actually doing the research is in some ways this process also gets easier once you've actually written some papers, because through the process of doing that, you can usually look back at your own papers and be like, ah, but I wish you'd like answered these questions or things like that. And that like also feeds into, you know, directions to go in, or like ways to form like a body of work, I guess.
Yeah. This feels more like in a way, you have to take a brute force approach. If that's what I'm getting to, it is more like a eventual gradient based. You know, like eventually you will learn. Yeah, you will try to deviate along a few of the paths, but eventually.
I wouldn't call it brute force, because you're not trying like everything. Not everything is not equal. You're trying out like a. Okay, so some people might come into it, like typically if you've had some research experience already, or you've been following some research area very closely and you've decided you're interested in that, then chances are like you probably have a good read of it and you should just go do that. But alternatively, what happens is sometimes people come into it and, you know, they have like a range of interests, but like they're not quite sure the exact like thing that they're interested in, or they're interested in exploring a few things. And then in that case, like, you know, it's nice to, you know, try out like a few things just to get a sense of it. And then that will also give you a sense of what you like. And then you can kind of go from there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, by brute force, I meant like in a strictly domain, like you'll have to pick up a domain where you will be doing a lot of explorations. But yeah, that's very interesting.
But still guided by your interests. Like you should still look at that.
Yeah.
Like the question you decide to work on should excite you. Like if you pick some question and you're like, I'm not sure why I'm working on this, that's like not the best thing to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And I recall this particular thing that you mentioned out in your blog that I read some time back, which talked about like your reflections of your PhD journey or something. And one interesting thing that you mentioned, which luckily I have never stuck into it as of now, at least I would say, is the idea of feeling stuck, you know, like as in feeling like you are not progressing, or for myriad of reasons, you could feel stuck. So can you talk more about that? Because I can hear these, I can actually sense that, okay, what feeling stuck might feel like down the line. But can you talk more about like why, what do you mean by feeling stuck in these kind of scenarios when you're doing your PhD or in general research projects? And what would be your advice as in like, if someone is feeling stuck about something, what's the approach he or she should have in order to, you know, get out of the stuck phase?
So I think I discussed some of this in my blog post, so people should definitely go check that out if they want more details. So during your PhD, there are going to be like, you know, various times where you have some project and it's like frustrating because it's like taking its like sweet time, or, you know, it's been rejected a couple of times and then you need to like work on it further to try and get it accepted somewhere, things like that. That's like, you know, those are common experiences, and those are like, you know, those are often okay. Like they're frustrating to go through, but they're not at a place where you're like despairing or something. I think there's another version that I've seen which I haven't experienced quite to the degree of extremeness, but I do know of other people who have had that experience, maybe even more so. And that's this phase where like it's usually earlier on in your PhD. So earlier on, you know, you're working on maybe like your first project or something, and you know, you're working on it and it just feels like you're not making any progress. Like you're trying all of these things and like things are either not working out, or like for some reason you feel like you're really stuck. And I think it's a big difference when it's like your first project as opposed to like a later project or one of a couple of projects, because it's common to get stuck on things. And like, you know, when you, as you have more research experience, you know how to handle that feeling also. Like you might have some other projects you concentrate on for a while. You could put this one on a pause, or like, if you have other papers and you write one paper and it's just like not going anywhere, maybe you decide to like return to some of the directions you want to explore out of one of your other papers and like explore that. So there are like, you know, lots of things you can do. I think the hardest point to get stuck is like maybe towards the beginning, if you're working on like a first project and like you just feel like, you know, it's hard to get it anywhere. And so for that one, I guess like, I think firstly, the most important thing to do is like to really take stock of like the state that you're in. So like, you know, what concrete things have like you done? Do you have any concrete results? Like, you know, like, and like any experiments or any other results? And like, often I've like found that like you can writing up like where you are at with like all of your intermediate results and things like that is a good place to, good thing to do, because you just get like a nice sense of state of like where things are at. And then so once you've gotten that, sometimes like just seeing that all come together, it's clear like what maybe the next step should be, or like why you're stuck. And so if that happens, then okay, great, you should go like do that. But you know, if you write this up and then you're like, I'm still not sure what to do, then there are, you know, like a few options. Like one option is to ask some of like, you know, maybe your other PhD students or like your advisor or other collaborators and things to take a look at this and see whether they have immediate thoughts on like what's going on. And oftentimes that can be quite useful. Like, you know, at some stages if you're stuck, and again, you have like these results, you know, presenting your work to somebody like at a workshop or like some intermediary phase can be really good, because again, like, through discussions and when you have like new pairs of eyes seeing it, like oftentimes like things can just come up that you might not have thought of, and then you might find that very interesting to look at. Another thing is to see whether like, you know, the things that you've done so far might have some connection to like some other direction that's interesting and like going on in the field. And so like, is there some connection there? Like, you know, are there related problems you could also study in this? Like, are there, do you want to like pivot certain aspects to like another, like maybe more tractable direction, things like that. And so like, you know, again, oftentimes like either looking for connections or like some slight reformulation or something might actually like sort of really solve the like being stuck problem. And then you might again find directions to like make progress. And then finally, there's this case which I don't think happens that often, but like very occasionally, I think it can happen that you might have just started with like, you know, just a very difficult project to begin with. And for some reason, you know, you've done this work and like it's been, you've tried all these things, you tried talking to other people, you tried seeing what connections there are, you've tried like, you know, reformulating the problem, all of that. You've like read through the current state and written it all up. Then at that stage, if you feel like nothing is working, then that could be time to like move on from the project, in which case it's worth just like, it is worth getting that final write-up just so you have a record of your work and, you know, you could post it onto the archive, for example. I think intermediate results or things that don't work are important for people to know and sort of share that. And then you could look at moving on to another project, hopefully informed by like some of the things that you've learned. So maybe you like realize like, you know, why maybe you got stuck here, and then maybe more promising directions to go at and making that transition.
Yeah. I completely agree to that, but in a very nice state, because I don't have that much amount of experience. But one thing I'm realizing is something that's really important to do a very stable amount of work is connecting the dots, as in like you might be trying out a lot of things, but if you really pick on the key findings that you had from like, okay, if something didn't work, what was the exact reason? And the next decision you take as in exploring, it has to come up from the past dots that you have connected or past findings that you have had. And so that's one thing that I'm learning, like as in I'm not going to take a blind vote onto exploring things, but I would be making a much more consensus-based decision, like, okay, right. Why should I do that?
That can definitely be useful. And then that can often also very easily end up with like a string of results that end up forming like a nice paper, because you like try one thing and then maybe it doesn't work, but then maybe there's some deeper reason why it doesn't work, and so then you explore that further and things like that, and then as you go through, suddenly you're like, oh well, this is like actually like a nice set of results, and this is the kind of thing that would be nice to like share in a paper or something.
Yeah. And one other question I had, but maybe like a tip from you that I can learn, is we talked about it in the early part of this podcast, is the field feels to be much more overwhelmed, right? Like it's too much amount of work for anyone to cope up with. So what were some of the tips that you would say you have right now as a researcher or as a research scientist that you can share versus what you would have as a graduate student? Like how did you keep up with so much amount of work that was being published, making a meaning out of it, and then extracting whatever information you can for your own research work? Like how do you manage? Yeah.
So I think once you have your specific interest defined, and like obviously I've been in the field for some years, so like I guess I have sort of the specific interest that I'm most excited about. It's okay to keep up with it, I'd say, like even at this stage, because you know, there I'm talking about something very specific. Like maybe I'm looking a lot at like, you know, representation analysis methods or something. And then like, you know, you'll see some papers and then come up. And then even if you don't quite read all of them, you're still seeing the evolution of like interesting papers come out and sort of things like that. I think keeping up with the field on the whole is like very hard. So that's not what I'd recommend. I'd say like for things that you're very interested in, like I think reading, I think, you know, kind of taking more effort to like, you know, like at least read abstracts. And then if you decide to work on something in that direction, try and read the entire paper, and like occasionally read entire papers, of course, is definitely a good thing to do. Then I think trying to make time for papers that have had like a huge impact on the field. So like, you know, some paper comes out and like just everyone is excited about it and talking about it, then like makes sense to like set aside time to try and really read that, to understand what's going on, what got people excited, things like that. And then if at some stage you're working on something and then, you know, you decide there's this other related area that you're excited on learning things about, then at that point you can try and get a whole number of papers in that area and just like read through them, you know, all together with like the goal of like learning as much as you can about that area. And that can be a great way to like quickly pick up on, you know, all the things that are happening. Also, I'd say that these days, again, because we have so many resources, there are a lot of things out there that you can go and then try and use too. So like, you know, there are like blog posts, there's code, there's like video tutorials, like all of those. So again, if there's like some area that you're excited about and you're seeing that people have presented like, you know, the results in various ways, or somebody else has written up a nice summary, that's like also a useful resource to take into account. It'll hopefully save you time in understanding the main points and then also convey those in a good way to you.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. But that's all I had for you, for the questions I had for this particular podcast. So I hope people listening to this find this useful. I'll be linking to, I'll be putting a link to your website. And how can people learn more about your recent works? I think how can they, because by no means we covered all of your works over here, so how can people learn more about your research works that you are working right now currently?
Thanks. So I would say I guess on my website I have my papers. I also have a Twitter account, like many other people on machine learning, where I share the findings of all our work, and then maybe check out like some of the other talks and things I've given. So we'll be attending Europe's. I'm also speaking at like one of the workshops there. This will be more on work on like human AI decision making related things. So I think, yeah, maybe that's another piece of advice. Talks are also a great way to learn about works that are out there. Coming from me and for other people, that's a nice thing to look at to see what people are working on now and some of the questions that they're thinking about.
Yeah, I'll be putting a link to all of the things that you mentioned in the description below. But yeah, hopefully, yeah, people can find information and they can reach out to you if they have any specific questions that they can ask. Yeah. So, but yeah, thanks a lot for being here. And I hope this was meaningful for people who are listening.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks so much for inviting me. And it was a really fun discussion. And, I wish any younger researchers who might be tuning into this, you know, best of luck with their PhDs, and definitely it's a very exciting time to be in the field. So exciting days and months ahead, I think.
Definitely. All right.